This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Your headlines for this hour: the death toll from Israel's latest military incursions into the occupied West Bank city of Jenin rises to 10. Dozens more are injured, some of them critically. The Israeli military forces thousands of Palestinians to leave their homes in the Jenin refugee camp, threatening to destroy the entire camp. And a senior Russian security official says confrontation with the West in Ukraine will last decades and the conflict with Kiev could become permanent. Thank you for joining us. After the Israeli military launched drone strikes on Jenin, the operation continues with ground incursions that the regime says will last for several days. A number of Palestinians have been killed and dozens wounded. The Israeli military has confessed the operation targets the resistance infrastructure in the refugee camp.
The Israeli military began a large-scale operation in the densely populated Jenin refugee camp under the claim of targeting terrorist infrastructure in Jenin, north of the occupied West Bank. The regime's military launched air raids on residential buildings there, followed by hundreds of ground forces storming the refugee camp. Several Palestinians have been killed and dozens wounded, in addition to the destruction of properties and roads. The Israeli forces have also closed off all entrances to the refugee camp with tractors, as they operate inside the camp with snipers stationed above buildings.
What's going on in Jenin is a war crime in the form of a military show. The situation is tough. The refugee camp has turned into a war zone. Aircraft strike the residential buildings where children and civilians are inside, and the forces shoot at ambulances to prevent them from rescuing the wounded. Gassers were fired at the hospitals in the refugee camp, and then their military spokesman says there is an American approval and green light for this crime.
The Israeli military said they have been planning on the offensive on Jenin refugee camp for a year. Around 150 armored vehicles and bulldozers and 1,000 to 2,000 soldiers were taking part in the operation. The Israeli military said it struck a joint operations center, which served as a command center for the Jenin Gates. This newly formed resistance group is comprised of fighters from different Palestinian armed groups. Israeli Minister of Military Affairs Yoav Gallant said the troops have full support to do whatever is necessary and to operate on the ground and in the air to protect the Israeli settlers. Nonetheless, an exchange of fire erupted between Palestinian fighters and Israeli soldiers admitted that at least one soldier was wounded.
This military operation has been planned for over a year, as if Jenin became one of the strongest enemies of Israel. This offensive will continue for a couple of days unless soldiers are killed, which might prolong the operation. Israel wants to weaken the residents in the Jenin refugee camp. They tried in the past and failed. On the contrary, those young fighters are becoming stronger.
Meanwhile, another Palestinian, 21-year-old Mohammed Hassanin, was killed by Israeli forces at the northern entrance to the city of Ramallah, near the military checkpoint of Beit Il. Since the beginning of this year, over 185 Palestinians have been killed. For weeks, there had been speculation of a major Israeli military operation in the northern occupied West Bank following a string of anti-Israeli shootings, intense resistance to the military raid. Analysts say the Jenin military operation is all about satisfying the bloodlust of Israeli settlers. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
The Israeli military offensive in Jenin has so far displaced some 3,000 Palestinians. The number is increasing, with the Israeli regime threatening to destroy the entire camp. Some residents said regime troops forced them to leave their homes and threatened to target them. They added that Israeli forces opened fire on them inside their homes. The mayor of Jenin says the extent of the destruction is large. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry condemned the expulsions and displacements. The Palestinian Factional Coordination Committee also announced a day of general strike in Bethlehem Governorate. There was also condemnation from the Islamic Jihad movement in the West Bank. It says the expulsions are one aspect of the transfer project that Israel seeks to implement in the West Bank. Meanwhile, Palestinians across the West Bank protest in solidarity with the people of Jenin amid a deadly Israeli military operation there. The demonstrators chanted slogans and held banners reading, "We are all Jenin and we are all with the resistance." Most towns across the West Bank are scenes of protests as anger's boiling over the military incursion in Jenin. Palestinian resistance factions have called on people in cities, villages and camps to confront the Israeli occupation and support the people of Jenin. Mukhaymer Abu Sada, professor of political science at Al-Azhar University, earlier joined us with his take on the ongoing conflict in the Jenin refugee camp.
According to Israeli media reports, that the Prime Minister of Israel, Netanyahu, and the Minister of Army, Yoav Gallant, and top Israeli military commanders have agreed this operation about 10 days ago. And what we are witnessing today is that more than 1,000 Israeli soldiers, tens or hundreds of Israeli military vehicles are trying to enter the refugee camp of Jenin. And in addition to that, Israeli military jets have struck the refugee camp in Jenin last night and this morning with 15 operations against the camp. Overall, this military operation has been prepared well by the Israeli army. And in the meantime, the Palestinian resistance groups, mainly the Jenin Brigade, which is composed mainly from the military wing of Islamic Jihad, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and other Palestinian factions, are trying their best to defend themselves, to defend Jenin and the refugee camp. According to many reports, some Israeli soldiers have fallen either dead or wounded by Palestinian resistance fighters. And it seems to me that this operation is going to go on for some time. I don't think that the Israeli army is about to stop this military aggression or to stop this military operation. I think we're going to see more aggression from the Israeli side against Jenin and the north of the West Bank.
A nuclear war involving Russia and Western countries is not just possible, but quite probable. The stark warning was issued by Dmitry Medvedev, who is now the deputy chairman of Russia's Security Council. In a newspaper article, the former Russian president added that current tensions between his country and the West are much worse than during the 1960s Cuban Missile Crisis. Medvedev said Moscow's confrontation with the West will last for decades, and his conflict with Ukraine could become permanent. Russia launched a war against Ukraine in February last year. Moscow says the war is aimed at demilitarizing and denazifying Ukraine, while Kiev's Western allies say it's an unprovoked land grab. As the Ukraine counteroffensive continues to falter, there are accusations from both sides that the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, the largest such plant in Europe, could be attacked, leading to a radiation leak and dangerous escalation of conflict. Johnny Miller reports from the plant.
The Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, the largest of its kind in Europe. President Zelensky has recently warned that Russia has mined it and is imminently planning to create a radiation leak. The IAEA, in a revisit, say they saw no evidence of those claims, and Russia denies it, warning Ukraine may attempt a terrorist attack of their own. The power plant, both sides are clearly, in one way or another, taking the potential damage or destruction of it very seriously. Recently, of course, the Novokakhovka dam was blown up, also along the Dnipro River. Whoever blew that up clearly has very little interest in the safety of local people and of potential ecological disaster. And as this war continues to escalate, many do fear that this plant really is under threat.
Built in the Soviet era and with likely strong Russian anti-air defense,
The destruction of the plant would not be easy. Risk has also been mitigated by the reactors being placed in cool shutdown. There is more of a fear that damage around the reactors themselves can lead to a radiation leak. Ukraine has tried hard to retake the plant. In October last year, 600 Ukrainian special forces reportedly crossed the Vaskakovka reservoir in boats in a failed and bloody attempt. The reservoir has now been turned into vast mudflats due to the blowing up of the dam. There is evidence of Ukrainian shelling around the plant, particularly in the nearby town of Energodar, although recent months have been quiet. One shell landed outside the central administration last year. The mayor tells me the plant is secure, but that he fears an attack. As well as concerns of a human and ecological disaster, there is an even greater fear that an attack can lead to another dangerous escalation of the conflict. Some officials in the US and UK have warned that a radiation leak would trigger Article 5 of the NATO treaty, meaning NATO would respond as if it were an attack on NATO itself. While some may be plotting an attack, most in the region and beyond will be hoping that the plant stays out of the news. Jenny Miller-Zafferosia.
South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa has officially invited his Iranian counterpart Ebrahim Raisi to attend the BRICS summit in Johannesburg. This was announced by the South African foreign minister during a phone call with the Iranian top diplomat. Naledi Pandor and Hossein Amir Abdollahian also discussed ways to expand ties between their countries. The Iranian foreign minister described as constructive the talks with his South African counterpart on the sidelines of the Friends of BRICS meeting in Cape Town last month. BRICS consists of Brazil, Russia, India, China and South Africa. The bloc is considering expanding its membership and it is amongst the countries that seek to join. Tehran has organized the sixth edition of the International Conference on American Human Rights from the perspective of the leader of the Islamic Revolution. The event has been held on the occasion of the American Human Rights Week in Iran. Salman Kujuri reports.
Scholars and thinkers from different countries have attended the sixth International Conference on American Human Rights from the perspective of the leader of the Islamic Revolution. The participants believe that the U.S. claims of defending human rights is a big lie and it only pursues its vested interests in different countries.
Supporting human rights has always been one of the most important slogans and claims of the United States of America. However, U.S. statesmen adopt their stance regarding human rights based on their political interests and preferences. This procedure has provided the U.S. instrumental use of human rights at the international arena. The U.S. is the biggest violator of human rights.
The American Human Rights Week occasion in Iran marks a series of tragic incidents, all falling within the same time frame, killing hundreds of Iranians in the early years after the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. One of the most tragic incidents was the 1988 shooting down of an Iranian airliner by the U.S. Navy, which killed all of the 290 people on board the plane, or the 1981 bombing of the headquarters of Iran Islamic Republic Party, carried out by the anti-Iran Mujahideen Khalq terrorist organization known as the MEK. 73 leading officials, including the then Justice Chief Ayatollah Mohammad Beheshti, were killed in the blast.
The U.S. always seeks to dominate other countries under the pretext of human rights. Whenever it sees its interests in danger, it makes an instrumental use of human rights to achieve its sinister objective.
Observers say Washington portrays itself as the defender of human rights across the globe, but it uses the issue as an excuse to exert pressure on other countries, while closing its eyes on its own rights violations.
Iranian officials and experts believe that the gravest violation of human rights is to politicize the issue, and this is exactly what the United States has done. Here, people believe that the title American Human Rights Week is a jab at Washington to question its double take on human rights and to expose it to the world. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
UK special forces may have killed up to 80 Afghan civilians between 2010 and 2013. The revelations were made by lawyers at a public inquiry into alleged war crimes by British troops. The lawyers say they have found credible evidence of a widespread pattern of unlawful and extrajudicial killings. They occurred as Special Air Service units carried out a policy of eliminating all fighting age males while raiding homes. The troops allegedly targeted young Afghan males, regardless of the threat they posed. One of the troops personally killed 35 Afghans during a six-month deployment. The lawyers say senior officers raised concerns at the time regarding British troops' casual disregard for life. However, military authorities responded with a wide-ranging and years-long cover-up. Journalist and political commentator Sayed Mohsen Abbas says the UK has committed a host of crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Well, there's been substantial evidence building up over many, many years about the war crimes of the British Army in both Afghanistan and Iraq, because the allegations that have been made, and there's a huge amount of evidence, as I said, includes death in custody, includes murder by the SAS soldiers themselves, child murder, beatings, torture, and even sex crimes. So the list is really quite horrific and quite ghastly. And what we seem to be seeing is the British Army doing its best to try and support the individuals involved, and also to cover up the entire policy of randomly attacking young Afghans. The Saifullahs and the Nurzais were the ones who triggered this particular investigation. Two families which were burst in upon by the British Army forces, special forces, and who summarily executed several of their family members and friends.
Sweden's embassy in London has become the latest location of Muslim protests as global anger continues to grow over Stockholm's decision to allow the desecration of the Quran by Islamophobic activists. Robert Carter reports from London.
Tensions between Sweden and the Muslim world remain high as protests over the Quran desecration in Stockholm continued across the weekend. In Britain, furious demonstrators vented outside Sweden's London embassy, vowing not to rest, and Sweden's government apologised and criminal charges were filed against the activist behind the sacrilegious act.
In an attempt to appease Muslim sentiment, the Swedish government has released a statement condemning the Quran burning on Eid Day, referring to it as Islamophobic. However, that's done little to quell the unrest, as well demonstrated with at least 2 days worth of action taking place outside Sweden's embassy in London.
Protesters explained why they felt more needed to be done to end the increasingly common anti-Islam acts in Europe.
This is something not accepted at all. So that's why we're here, and we'll be here again and again until we hear some serious and legal actions taken against this person, and is being banned in Sweden and other countries where they allow this action, which is against the whole humanity as a whole, because it could be somebody else's holy book. It's not only about Islam, it's about the peace around the world.
Sweden has faced similar global condemnation for its defence of Quran desecration in the past. January saw a similar far-right demo outside Turkey's embassy in Stockholm. The incident sparked worldwide protests and soured already poor relations with Ankara. Sweden also was the home of a notorious cartoonist, Lars Vilks, who depicted Islam's prophet in an insulting way back in July 2007. Ankara has since refused Sweden's requests to join the NATO military alliance. Sweden can only achieve membership if all current NATO members accept the application. This tense standoff seems likely, for now, to change. Robert Carter, London.
Well, that's it for this hour's bulletin. Take care and bye-bye.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
I IRIB English Radio.
Under the starry sky of the desert, from the very heart of evergreen forests, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, closer, Iran,
these are
Salam. I'm a nature enthusiast and traveler. In Close Up Iran, I introduce you to the wonders and beauties of my country, Iran. Stay with me. Dreamed of staying in a forest during the night. And tonight my dream has come true. Actually, I have accompanied a professional nature traveling team which aims to get familiar with the fauna of the Caspian Hyrkanian forests of Gilan province. In particular, Iran's rare roe deer known as Shuka. What makes this miniature deer so special is that upon feeling danger, it makes a sound similar to a dog's bark. So I have to go to bed early, because tomorrow could be a very exciting day. This is my flashlight. And I zip up my sleeping bag. Good night. Shuka roe deer, also known as the roe, is a species of deer living in Iran. Shuka roe deer is found in northern Iran, in the Caspian region. They are found in the Hyrkanian woodlands and agricultural lands of the Alborz Mountains, Golestan National Park, Jahannama Protected Area. What makes this miniature deer so special is that upon feeling danger, it makes a bizarre sound. Well, I woke up early in the morning. I had a great breakfast and I'm ready for long time hiking. The team members are also ready and seem to be very excited. Before I pack up, I'd better tell you that the place I am now is like a patch of paradise. Hyrkanian forests are actually one of the most important natural reserves of the world. So for Shuka, there is no place better than Hyrkanian forests. It's time to set off. I'm ready. Let's go. Are always special. However, this forest is unique, and I just need to spot Shuka. Shukas are active both during nights and days. During summer, they live individually and have their own territory. And during winter, they make small groups. It's interesting to note that shukas have a strong sense of smell. They also have wonderful visual and auditory senses. And they are professional swimmers. In normal situations, they are very calm. But when they feel danger, they jump at great heights. And I'm eagerly waiting to hear their special sound. Oh my god! Their sound doesn't match their shape! Shh! What? Shh! Okay! I speak quietly, okay? It seems they have spotted a shuka. God, look at them. They are the same size as gazelles. The only difference is that shukas have a kind of hunch on their back, yes. They have short tails and their hair is reddish brown in color and soft. However, in winter, their hair becomes gray. Oh, look! That one is their baby! Oh, the mother is caressing its baby. Oh, did you hear its sound? The sound doesn't match such a cute creature. Shukas have precious ecological values and they are a great case study for scientists. And it's so good that these animals live in Hyrkanian forest, which is a well-protected area for them.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
With the presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Very welcome to another episode of the program Viewpoints. I am Atta, the host of this program. Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi and Shaykh Rouhani are two special guest speakers for today's discussion. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Shaykh Rouhani, assalamu
alaikum. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
So for today's discussion, we want to talk about the main message of the Qadir event. We know that on the Qadir event, in a place called Qadir Khum, Prophet Muhammad, by the order of Allah, selected Imam Ali alayhi salam as his successor. And it was Hajjatul Wada, isn't it? A kind of farewell hajj. It was the only Hajj of Prophet Muhammad after Islam. So Qadir Khum event took place, you know. So now Qadir Khum event is the milestone for the unity or the Wahda of the Ummah. But unfortunately nowadays, the people all across the world and the Muslims accuse Shias that Qadir Khum event is a kind of disagreeing line between you and us. Why this took place? I mean, the main message and the original message has been changed into something else, Sayyid Mohsen.
Well, obviously, there are two reasons. One is the political reason.
Yes.
And when we talk about the political reason is that, especially, you know, there are people who do not want to accept the Ahlul Bayt, and they are the followers of Umayyad Caliphate, we say. And they don't want to follow the true Islam. The other reason is that because the interpretations were different. And unfortunately, since the rulership that we had after the Prophet, for example, the Umayyad Caliphate, after that we had the Abbasid Caliphate, they all were opposing Ahlul Bayt, alayhi salam.
Yes.
Therefore, they never wanted this event of Ghadir to be expressed in its true way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we had different interpretations. And then it went into the people, and the scholars also made their own comments in yes. order to differentiate or change the meaning of even the words of the hadith, as our respected guest has said, like Mawla as the meaning of love.
Yes.
So basically, it was a political, we can say, concern that due to which the meaning was changed. But what we can see is we can see that obviously this is the matter of unity in today's world. If, you know, a time which we want to think where all the Sahaba, they all were united at one place in front of Prophet.
Mm-hmm.
That was the place of Ghadir.
Yes.
Where Imam Ali was there. For example, Abu Bakr and Umar, they both have went to Imam Ali. They said, "Anta Mawlai, you're my master." You know, even if you take the meaning of friend, doesn't matter. Take a meaning of friend for sometime. Yeah.
Now, what is the need to do bay'ah with a person
yes.
and say, "You are my friend"?
So you say, "You're my friend," for example.
Yes.
Wa mawlaya kulli mu'min wa mu'minatin.
Okay.
And the friend of all the mu'minin and mu'minat.
Mm.
So was he the enemy before that?
Mm-hmm.
That's the question, basically.
Okay.
Was he enemy that the Prophet when made, you know, this? And if the Prophet was concerning the friendship at that time, they should say, "Now, those who oppose you," you know, the statement should be in this way, that those who oppose you, now they're your friend. And no one is, you know, we can say like enemy with you or have enmity with you. So this should be the statement, whereas the statement is different.
Even they say there was a tent established.
Yes.
And the wives and the women of the tribes went there and did bay'ah with Imam Ali alayhi salam.
So they all have taken the oath.
Why the women must say that you are my friend?
Yes.
Okay.
So it doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't make any sense. That's right.
So the original meaning is that the master.
Yes.
Now, why is it the way of unity? It's because especially the supreme leader also has said that the Ghadir is the point of unity. It is
yes.
because this is the incidence where we have 124,000 companions of the Prophet gathered on the day of Hajj, for example, on the day of Ghadir. And they all witnessed. And there is no other, we can say, there is no other tradition other than this, that the Prophet has said that, Man kunta mawlahu fa aliyun mawla. So all have witnessed it. There are 1,000, you know, companions who have said this, that the Prophet has said. So this was the matter of unity, basically. And even I say in today's world, those who believe that Imam Ali was announced as a friend. Mm-hmm. So why you make Shias enemies of you? Mm-hmm. You should believe that the followers of Ali ibn Abi Talib are friends of you.
Okay.
Why you kill them?
Yes.
Why you oppress them? You know, the things that happen in Yemen, the things that are happening in Pakistan or other places.
Yes.
How the Takfiris are killing the Shias. So, or maybe they are the, you know, the ulama or the scholars, Sunni ulama, some, they do Takfir Shias. They say like Shias are kafir. Why you do this?
Yes.
Whereas your master, like the ones you think they are the authority over you, they have said the Ali ibn Abi Talib is my mawla and mawla of kulli mu'min and mu'mina. All the believing men and believing women. So therefore, it is a matter of the politics, that when it comes in the politics, when people are involved in, you know, in politics, they try to make difference. Why? Because otherwise, if they don't do that,
yes,
they cannot prove their own authority over others or their own righteousness.
That's right.
They cannot prove this.
And on different occasions after Qadir Khum event, when the right of Imam Ali alayhi salam was forgotten and neglected, mm-hmm, on different occasions Imam Ali alayhi salam and other companions tried to remind and recall this event, the most important, which is the event of Ruhba. You know, we know that in the event of, we can say, Ruhba in the year 35, according to the Hijri calendar, according to Allama Hamini, Imam Ali alayhi salam asked about the priority of himself over leadership and Imam of the Muslim Ummah, and the other companions now, we can say, did bay'ah again, that this happened and we were an eyewitness, so this and that. And this has been mentioned in both Sunni and Shia references. Hazrat Fatima to Zahra also has claimed this on different,
and you know, after
occasions,
that they changed the meaning. For example, in today's world, we see some scholars, they say that, yes, Ali is the leader and master in the spiritual journey.
Okay.
Whereas in the governorship or the apparent government, Islamic mm-hmm. government, there are these khulafa or caliphate system. So okay. They're now changing the meaning in this way.
So now what's happened that after 3 main caliphs, they again get back to Ali alayhi salam? So why is this happening? So what happens now to select Imam Ali alayhi salam, as Sayyid says, for the government again? So if Ali was only for the spiritual journey, why now, after 25 years, you again want to do bay'ah with Imam Ali alayhi salam? Okay, Sheikh Rouhani, so as you said, this has been under the shadow of the Holy Quran and the other ahadith. Allama Amini has compiled voluminous books, Al-Ghadir, and this has been, but nowadays we do not see such authenticity among the Muslims. Why? I mean, the Muslims all around the world, they do not have enough knowledge about Qadir Khum event. Whose responsibility is this? And why this historical lack of knowledge took place?
You know, actually, we cannot say that the scholars, Muslim scholars, they know all about this event of Ghadir. The problem is that the misinterpretation of the terms and the words that are used by the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, they misinterpret that.
Okay.
They knew what happened because it is mutawatir. It is uninterruptedly narrated by many of the companions, and it is not something that we can say that it's not mutawatir. For the majority of the normal Muslims, the ordinary people, they might not be aware of this event.
Yes.
Because everything is controlled, you know, and all the societies, you know, that the mass media and all things are under the control of the political systems in those countries, that they do not allow
yes.
the people to know about this. Otherwise, if you refer to their traditional sources, to their majama wal ahadith, to the historian, for example, sources, historical sources, you know that everything is mentioned about Ghadir.
Okay.
And it's very famous, it's very well known. And also this sentence, nice phrase of the Holy Prophet, Man kuntu mawla fa hadha aliyun mawla, it is a very well known sentence, which is everybody knows about it. But of course, we have nowadays this responsibility to be a muballigh of Ghadir, and
yes.
to actually express and to convey this message of Ghadir to the people, because it could unite us. Because, you know, when we go to Ghadir, when we refer to the event of Ghadir, it has lots of lessons for the Ummah, for the Muslim Ummah, not only for the Shiites. For example, when the Holy Prophet wasallam says that you have to love Amir al-Mu'mineen wasallam, so love and muhabba and devotion from moral perspective, from ethical perspective, yes, is very much important, that we should express love to the Ahlul Bayt, to the Amir al-Mu'mineen. So it is an order that the Holy Prophet commands all of us,
yes,
not only the Shias, all Muslims, that you have to love Amir al-Mu'mineen, mm-hmm, that you have to love the Ahlul Bayt. Yes. So from moral perspective, morally, yes, talking, not politically, how do you express your love to Amir al-Mu'mineen nowadays? Mm-hmm. You know, this is a very important question for all Muslims. And
that's
from,
right,
social perspective, again, we see that the Holy Prophet ﷺ says that if you unite and gather around Amir al-Mu'mineen ﷺ, we would be a kind of united nation,
yes,
a united ummah. You know, it gives us unity. Because unity in Islamic ummah does not mean that we ignore and reject all the different denominations.
Yes.
It doesn't mean that. We have to focus all different sects, all different branches of Islam, they have to focus on the shared and common things,
right,
that we have in common.
Yes.
One of them is Ghadir.
Yes.
Ghadir is something that is common,
yes,
among,
okay,
all of us.
Yes.
So we can focus on it, we can give it, we can take it seriously as something that can unite us.
Mm-hmm.
Like we have Wahid Qibla, Qibla, our,
yes,
Qibla,
yes,
is one.
Yes.
Our God is one, our,
yes,
book is one, you,
yes,
know? Our Prophet is one.
Yes.
Our Ghadir is also one.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a sign, it is a symbol of unity among Muslim ummah, Muslim nation.
Yes.
It gives us unity if we,
yes,
express the message of, or convey the message of Ghadir to the whole Muslim nation.
Mm-hmm.
It gives us unity, you know, because it is something in common and shared between all the Muslims.
And consider now we are in the Hajj season, for example.
Yes, of course.
For,
yeah,
example, we can say the key holders of Kaaba gather all the people of the Hajj pilgrimage and say, we have one important message regarding your health, for,
yes,
example, okay?
Yeah, of course.
That do this and do that for your health. For sure, the people will listen to you, okay? So now consider that Prophet Muhammad, okay, stops all the people, wait for all of them from different tribes come and,
yeah,
said,
of course, yeah,
I have a message for you,
yeah, even
from
if,
Allah subhanahu,
yeah,
wa ta'ala.
Even if the meaning of Mawla is love, is friendship.
Affection, yes.
Yeah, you know, again, we should ask all Muslims that, oh, Muslim brothers, oh, Wahhabis, or Salafis, or Hanafis, Malikis, all of you,
yes,
please come together and love Amir al-Mu'mineen.
Yes.
What is the problem with this?
Mm-hmm.
Let's love Amir al-Mu'mineen, let's follow Amir al-Mu'mineen, because it is something that we are in common, that we have shared in common,
yes,
ideas about him.
That's right.
So if we follow the one whom we love, all of us, then it unites us. Because,
mm-hmm,
we do not have such a sentence about the first caliph, or second caliph, or third caliph, or the other companions.
That's,
we,
right,
have only about Amir al-Mu'mineen, this kind of sentence. Let's come together around this sentence of Amir al-Mu'mineen, around this commandment of the Holy,
yes,
Prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, and obey the Holy Prophet.
Mm-hmm. Surah Ma'idah.
Adding
okay,
one thing with,
yes, yes,
what our dear guest has said, that, you know, in the love we have to do that. But on the other hand, we have other hadith as well.
Mm-hmm.
If you want knowledge, come to the door of Ali.
Yes.
Ana Madinatul Ilmi wa Aliyun Baba.
Yes,
if you,
yes,
want wisdom, ana Darul Hikmat wa Aliyun Baba.
Okay.
So all these things, that's, you know, the point of unity, that,
mm-hmm,
even if you want knowledge, don't go anywhere else. Because,
mm-hmm,
Prophet has introduced,
yes,
one door.
Yes.
And that is Ali ibn Abi Talib.
Okay. The different verses as ayah, Surah Ma'idah, ayah 3, Surah Ma'idah, ayah 67, and also Surah Ma'araj, ayah 1 and 2, referring to Nu'man ibn Haris story, that, for example, asking if Ali is my Mawla now, let Allah's curse be my own hand, and the piece of a stone comes, you know, and breaks his head, he dies. So different stories and different, we can say, ayahs of the Holy Quran referring to Ghadir event. Thank you, my Sayyid Mohsen Nawi and Sheikh Rouhani, for a nice elaboration regarding the message of Ghadir. It was very kind of you. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. The another episode. God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
shining bright, you came to us with a heart so full of love, and you showed that you're the one who cares the most, and to us you've always been so close. Everyone will say, please save me, accept Al-Habib. Ummati, Ummati, yaquluha lana yawm al-qiyamati. Ummati, Ummati, yaquluha shafa'atan ana laha.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
With hundreds of fires raging, Toronto, New York, and Washington, D.C. have the world's unhealthiest air. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT noted, Toronto and New York stood in first and second place on a list of the world's most polluted urban areas compiled by IQ Air recently. With wildfires burning in Canada, a choking smoke, it has spread to major American metropolitan areas. More than 500 fires have been burning across several Canadian provinces for almost a month, spreading an orange-brown haze across eastern Canada and the U.S. Midwest and Northeast. The heavy concentration of particulate matter in the smoke has led public health officials to hand out masks and instruct people to remain indoors. More than 120 million Americans, a third of the population, were living under some kind of air quality alert, CNN reported. Toronto has recently had the worst air quality of any city in the world, according to a live index compiled by IQ Air, a Swiss air filter company. Torino scored 154 on the company's index, making its air unhealthy for anyone to breathe. New York City and Washington, D.C. followed in second and third place with respective scores of 142 and 120. IQ Air considers an air quality of between 100 and 150 to be unhealthy for sensitive groups. Montreal, Chicago, and Detroit are also in the top 10 on IQ Air's list, alongside cities more commonly associated with air pollution, such as Beijing, Hanoi, and Calcutta. Earlier this week, Chicago and Detroit alternated between first and second place until prevailing winds pushed some of the smoke east. Residents of the Canadian province of Ontario and Ohio River Valley, which includes areas of New York, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana, Kentucky, West Virginia, and Tennessee, have reported smelling burning plastic in the air. According to the Weather Network, this phenomenon occurs when smoke has lingered in the air for so long that the sun's radiation begins to break it down to release toxic benzene and formaldehyde. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has described the 2023 wildfire season as unprecedented and the worst since records began. While wildfire season usually peaks in mid-July, more emissions have already been released this year than any other year on record, according to a report published recently by Copernicus, the European Union's Earth Observation Program. Trudeau has blamed the fires on climate change, while his critics argue that poor forest management and a refusal by the authorities to engage in controlled burns are the true causes of the disastrous blazes. Also, Axios reported the smoke from unprecedented wildfires in Canada triggered poor air quality alerts over swathes of the U.S. again, with multiple cities reporting some of the worst air pollution levels of any major city around the world. While continuing to choke the Great Lakes region and the upper Midwest, the low-lying smoke also drifted southeast and began affecting Ohio Valley and mid-Atlantic cities. Canadian cities, too, were also greatly affected by the smoke, with the Toronto reporting the worst air quality for major cities around the world, according to Swiss air technology company IQ Air. Smoke from unprecedented Canadian wildfires, which have been exacerbated by human-caused climate change and global warming, has repeatedly choked North American cities this summer, and additional rounds of smoke may follow. Canada is experiencing its worst wildfire season on record, driven by extreme heat events and exacerbating drought conditions, according to data from the Canadian Interagency Forest Fire Center, CIFFC. Because of their size, locations, and behavior, the fires are not expected to be extinguished anytime soon, either by firefighters or a major shift in weather conditions until after summer ends, Axios Andrew Friedman reports. Inhaling wildfire smoke when it's present in high concentrations at ground level can cause serious health complications and is especially dangerous for elderly populations and people with heart ailments or asthma. An Air Quality Action Day was declared for all of Northeast Illinois and Northwest Indiana, meaning fine particulate matter and other pollutants could build to unhealthy levels in the outdoor air. Air quality alerts across Upper Midwest are expected to remain in effect, according to the National Weather Service. Chicago had the second worst air quality for major cities around the world, with a 181 or a code red on the Air Quality Index, which is considered dangerous for sensitive groups. Detroit and Minneapolis followed with the second and third worst levels, respectively. Cleveland, which wasn't included in IQ Air's ranking system, had an AQI of 238, which is considered dangerous for all people. An Environmental Protection Agency monitor near Chippewa Lake, Ohio, was reporting an AQI of 309, which is a code maroon, the highest alert level of the index. The Cleveland skyline couldn't be seen from live cameras positioned just a few miles from a shore, while visibility at the city's international airport fell to 1.25 miles multiple times throughout the day. A slight haze and the smell of smoke were present in Washington, D.C., where air quality fell to levels unhealthy to sensitive groups of people. The smoke caused a thick haze in downtown Chicago, reducing visibility at Chicago O'Hare International Airport to 1.25 miles for several hours on several days. Winds have also carried the smoke across the Atlantic Ocean over to Europe, where the sun was partially shrouded in areas of Portugal and Spain. 476 wildfires were burning across Canada, including 234 out-of-control fires. CIFFC reported that 2,957 fires this season have burned 19.3 million acres, 7.8 million hectares in Canada, which is an area equivalent to all of Michigan's forest land. The reported total number of fires jumped to 2,988, while the burnt acreage went up to around 19.8 million acres, 8 million hectares.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.